there, Freaky Fam, and welcome to another episode of Mads, Monsters, and Maniacs. I'm your host, Mads. I just really need you guys to know that every single time I hold the microphone before I actually start recording, I'm testing to make sure I can hear it in my headphones, and I definitely do ridiculous ballads of songs that I have no business singing. So happy November. We have officially hit November time. It's been like pretty dark and dreary here recently. Usually right after Halloween is when that sort of nasty-ish weather hits. Like it'll be very foggy in the mornings and I'm like, oh, Halloween has not left us. Okay. And as much as I love Halloween and all of the haunted, spooky goodness, I'm also a very big fan of the holidays. I'm so super duper excited for the holiday season. Don't worry, I'm still drinking out of my Halloween trick-or-treat cup right now, but I also have a dilemma where I don't know where I'm going to put a Christmas tree this year. I did not decorate at all last year at my old job. I used to work overnights during the holidays, so there just really didn't seem like a purpose for me to decorate. But I also, one of my cats used to, I will say used to, really enjoy chewing on electrical cords. I've had to replace, the cable that plugs into the cable box. I've replaced countless computer chargers, phone chargers. I've had to throw out a electrical fan, all kinds of different things. And Christmas tree was one of those things. And I ended up buying a new one because he chewed the cord off, like the plug. It was just sitting in the outlet. And I was like, why isn't my tree lit up? And it's because he chewed the cord off. So I don't think he really does it much anymore because he did have an incident where he was lightly electrocuted. No worries. He is 100% okay. There are a few things I want to talk about before we get started. First of all, I received a message on Instagram today and this girl told me that she really likes the podcast and was like super sweet, really encouraging. But she also told me that she felt like she was listening to Morbid. And when I tell you, I made the ugliest, like, sad face because that meant so much to me. I absolutely love the Morbid girls so much. I listen to them all the time. So thank you so much for reaching out and saying that to me. It really boosted me today. The other thing I want to talk about is I have noticed we've been getting a couple new followers and things like that on Instagram. So first of all, if you are new here, hi, hello, my name is Madison, but I go by Mads, and Mads Monsters Maniacs is a true crime podcast where we talk about all kinds of spooky things. We'll talk about true crime, we'll talk about folklore, we'll talk about haunted places, just kind of D, all of the above. But the second thing I wanted to talk about is when you are going to comment on the Instagram page, I completely agree. I know we don't give a flying fuck about the murderers or their feelings. I'm 100% behind you. But let's be mindful and not compare them to a group of people or someone who deals with disability or something like that. That is not okay. I don't agree with that. If you're going to attack shit on them, let's call them asshats. Let's call them sickos, all kinds of other names, but don't compare them to another group of people. So I was having a lot of trouble picking a case for this week's episode. I was going to do a requested episode of a cult, but I was having so much difficulty finding any sort of information about it. So that one's gonna sit on the back burner. It'll still be in the works. It will eventually come. But then I started scrolling through some of the other cases that I had already written up because I'm not gonna lie, I was a little late in the game this week, but none of them were piquing my interest. There was one case I really did want to talk about, but it's a smaller case. Like, it's very open shut, but not really a resolution, you know, and it's crazy. So since it was not going to be a big episode or anything, it would literally turn into like a mini episode. I decided to weight on that one as well. And then at some point, I somehow landed on Amityville. So I do enjoy a good haunting, but if you don't know, that is or isn't quite all about the case. So let's just go ahead and start at the beginning. Ronald Joseph DeFeo Jr., also referred to as Butch, was born on September 26, 1951. A book I read called The Amityville Massacre, The DeFeo Family's Nightmare, did list his birthday as the 25th, but I just wanted to chime in with that information. He was born in Brooklyn, New York, to his parents Ronald Sr. and Louise DeFeo. He was the eldest of five children, and they would end up having a pretty significant age gap. We'll get into that whenever we talk about it a little bit more later. Ronald Sr. made a pretty good living for the family, working as a car salesman for a Buick dealership owned by his father-in-law in Brooklyn. Ronald Sr. did provide a home for the family in 1965, but he was described as a domineering authority figure and would often have heated arguments with his wife and children. Ronald Jr. was reportedly the one that faced the most abuse from his parents, but he also did face a lot of bullying in school due to his weight. As he aged, he became a lot bigger, a lot stronger, and ended up starting to fight back against his father. According to one authority, shouting matches often degenerated into boxing matches as father and son came to blows with little provocation. Other people also became victim to Ronald Jr.'s outburst and belligerent behavior, unfortunately. At some point, Ronald Jr.'s parents wanted him to receive psychiatric help, which he was not happy about. This was 100% against his will. He didn't see an issue with himself. He didn't want to go, but they were forcing him. They realized after therapy ended that it was not helping his frequent violent episodes, so they ended up giving him money and gifts to get him to calm down. It's honestly all around sad, because in one way it seems like they're kind of enabling that behavior, especially if I definitely think there was some sort of mental something happening behind the scenes, but also if his father was being very abusive towards everyone in the family, and he was the oldest, so he was taking the brunt of it. But I mean, giving him money and gifts to get him to calm down, that's a little ridiculous. Like, he knows if he acts up again, they're just going to give him money and gifts. One of the gifts that he did receive was a $14,000 speedboat. I cannot even begin to imagine what that would cost today. I have no idea what I would do with that kind of money. I mean, I'd probably pay off my bills, but like, that's more money than my car. Things continued to go downhill for Ronald Jr. By age 17, he was using heroin and LSD and would commit petty thefts. He ended up being kicked out of school due to violence, and the DeFeos wouldn't necessarily turn a blind eye to his behavior, but they did what they could to get their son back on the right track. When he was 18, they got him a job at the family dealership, along with a new car and a weekly allowance that had no strings attached. But alas, Ronald Jr. took advantage of this and would use the money to further his abuse of drugs and alcohol. I wish my parents would give me a weekly allowance. So around this time, he started becoming interested in firearms. And if anyone watches, her name on TikTok is Ali_Belairs. All I can think of when I read that was red flag, red flag. There was an instance where Junior took a 12-gauge shotgun to his father's head during an altercation between Ronald Sr. and Luis. The gun, however, malfunctioned, and that saved Ronald Sr.'s life. In October 1974, Junior tried to embezzle over $20,000 from the car dealership that he was supposed to deposit to the bank. He and a friend had made a plan to split the money after faking a robbery. But police started figuring out what was going on, and after pointing the finger at Ronald Jr., he was pissed. When Ronald Sr. started to believe that his son had been behind it and started to speak aloud to the stonewalling with the authorities, Ronald Jr. threatened his father's life. On November 13, 1974, at about 6:30 p.m., Ronald Jr. went to Henry's Bar in Amityville, distressed and shouting, "Help me, I think my mother and father are shot." Friends followed him back to the family's home at 112 Ocean Avenue, where they confirmed the death of his parents. They called the Suffolk County Police Department, and when detectives arrived, they discovered six members of the DeFeo family. They had been shot execution style in their beds, each victim lying on their stomach. Ronald was brought in for questioning, and he claimed that his family had been murdered by a hitman that was hired from the mob, suggesting that there had been bad blood between the mob and the car dealership. Ronald was then placed into protective custody while police investigated his claim. However, a further search of the DeFeo residence turned up an empty box in Ronald DeFeo Jr.'s room that was for a 35 caliber Marlin 336C rifle that he had purchased. Detectives began pressing Ronald about his story, which then started to fall apart. They had the estimated time of death, and they had a pretty good idea of the sequence of death. I mean, obviously, they knew that they had been shot, but, you know, ballistics, things like that. The next day, Ronald did confess that he had murdered his family. He claimed, "Once I started, I just couldn't stop. It went so fast." At the time, Ronald was on probation as well as being surveillanced for drug usage. During his confession, he said that after the killings, he took a bath, put on fresh clothes, and removed all evidence, including his bloody clothes, the murder weapon, and cartridges. At about 3:15 a.m., he first went into his parents' bedroom, where he shot both of them twice. According to a crime library report, Ronald DeFeo Sr. was the main target at first. The first shot went into his back that tore through his kidney and then exited through his chest. Ronald Jr. then shot his father again, and the bullet went through his back. This shot pierced the base of his spine and lodged into his neck. Luis was next. He shot her twice as well. The bullet shattered her ribcage and collapsed her right lung. Ronald then went into the bedroom of his 12-year-old brother Mark and 9-year-old brother John, shooting both boys a single time. He lastly went into the bedroom of 18-year-old Dawn and 13-year-old Allison, also firing a single shot to both girls. Ronald Jr. was 23 years old at this time. The entire massacre took about 15 minutes, and as we know, he took a shower and then cleaned up before he went off to work for the day. You know, casually, what you do on a nightly basis at about 3:15 a.m. and then you just stay awake, get ready, throw out the evidence, go to work for the day. You know, casual. He put all of the evidence in a pillowcase and tossed them into a storm drain on his way to the dealership, where he arrived at about 6 a.m. He then had to cover his tracks and explain that he didn't know why his father hadn't called or shown up for work that day. By noon, he left the dealership to see friends, to drink, do drugs, to basically help establish an alibi for himself. And that pretty much catches us up back to where we were with the aftermath. His family was laid to rest at the St. Charles Cemetery in Farmingdale, New York. So obviously, Ronald was arrested, and on October 14th, 1975, Ronald went on trial for the mass slaying of his family. Representing the state was Suffolk County Assistant District Attorney Gerard Sullivan. In his opening statement, Sullivan was candid when saying, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, each of you will be changed to some degree by this case. You will leave this courtroom after rendering a verdict perhaps a month from now, carrying with you an abiding memory of the horror that occurred in the house at 112 Ocean Avenue in the dead of night 11 months ago." Ronald obviously went for the insanity defense, testifying that he was possessed by Satan while committing the crimes, but then also saying it was an act of self-defense because his family was conspiring against him, according to who? The voices in his head. While on the stand, Ronald's attorney asked him point blank in the face, "Did you kill your father?" To which he then responded, "Did I kill him? I killed them all. Yes, sir. I killed them all in self-defense." Honey, it's yes or no. We all know it's yes, but it's yes or no. When asked why, Ronald stated, "As far as I'm concerned, if I didn't kill my family, they were going to kill me. What I did was self-defense and there was nothing wrong with it. Which honestly blows my mind because I'm like, your family was trying to help you. They were trying to get you psychiatric care. Like, they were just very concerned about your well-being and as well as theirs. Unfortunately, they had a clear reason to be. So during the trial, they had two different psychiatrists there. One argued in favor of the defense and the other one was arguing in favor of the prosecution. The one arguing for the defense was Dr. Daniel Schwartz, and he was supporting the insanity argument, claiming that that Ronald was neurotic and suffered from dissociative disorder. But the prosecution psychiatrist was Dr. Harold Zolin, and he had talked about how Ronald was abusing LSD and heroin and suffered from antisocial personality disorder. But he was still able to distinguish the difference between right and wrong, especially when he was murdering his family. I mean, obviously, he had plenty of time to be like, you know what, maybe I shouldn't do this. Especially because there were six members in that family. You could have stopped at any time. You didn't have to hurt your siblings. You didn't even have to hurt your parents. Also during the trial, it was also argued that the murders were financially motivated, claiming that Ronald would cash the life insurance policies for not only his parents, but his siblings. And then obviously, because the dealership is in his family, he would end up getting a portion of that as well. On November 21st, 1975, the insanity defense failed to convince the jury, and Ronald DeFeo Jr. was convicted unanimously of six counts of second-degree murder. Blows my mind it was second degree, though. I mean, obviously, they wouldn't have really had a way to prove premeditation, but I also feel like buying that gun was premeditated enough. On December 4th, 1975, he was sentenced by Judge Thomas Stark, six concurrent terms of 25 years to life at the Green Haven Correctional Facility in Beekman, New York. Of course, after his conviction, he started changing his story multiple times, and they got more and more inventive afterwards. Come on, Ronald, we love creative men. During an interview with Newsday in 1986, Ronald stated that it was actually his 18-year-old sister Dawn that had murdered their father. Then, their hysterical mother killed Dawn and her other children, and afterwards, Ronald then shot his mother after seeing what she had done. Then his next story claimed that it was Dawn and another person, someone Dawn knew apparently, but this other person murdered their parents, and then Dawn had shot their siblings. In this story, Ronald battled for the rifle against Dawn and accidentally shot and killed her. They did use this story to file a 440 motion, which basically is to vacate a criminal conviction, and the motion was denied by the same judge who said, I find the testimony of the defendant overall to be false and fabricated. Another reason for my disbelief of the defendant's testimony is demonstrated by consideration of several portions of the trial testimony. He signed a lengthy written statement describing in detail his activities. Defendant's testimony that he did not shoot and kill the members of his family is likewise incredible and not worthy of belief. Like, good for you, Judge. Really good for you. Also, there are things that don't make sense if that is the case. First of all, why is he going after Dawn? Is it just because she was the second oldest? I don't really get it. Second of all, if that were true, I think they would have noticed some defense wounds if you were fighting with her over the gun. And then did you put everyone back in bed that same way? And then after you accidentally shot her, instead of calling the authorities or anything, you just got dressed and went to work. Doesn't really make sense. We can tell that you came up with the story later and you were like, fuck, I should have started with that. Makes no sense, sir. Makes no sense. So, of course, like most famous true crime cases, there were a lot of controversies in this case because of the unlikelihood that nobody woke up during the shootings. I did read in that book that I mentioned, and there will be a link to it as well, that there was evidence that Luis and Allison were awake during the attack. The investigation had concluded that there wasn't a silencer used on the rifle, and they did find evidence that he used sedatives, which would explain nobody waking up during the shots. He did admit during questioning that he had drugged his family, but the autopsy report said otherwise. They performed an extensive blood test, toxicology report, tested organs, tested urine, and it all came back negative for drugs. And then the neighbors all stated that they didn't hear any gunshots that night. The only thing that they heard was a family dog barking. Obviously, he did it. He killed them. Maybe it was raining that night. That's why nobody heard it. But Ronald did die at age 69 on March 21st, 2021. So this year, baby. But they still haven't released a cause of death. I want to know. I want to know if his ass was shanked. I just want to know. All right, so that pretty much concludes the original murders and what had happened there. So now why don't we get into these alleged hauntings, shall we? So on December 18th, 1975, the Lutz family moved into the DeFeo home. It had only been about 13 months after the murders, and George and Kathleen Lutz thought the house was lovely and such a steal for $80,000. But of course, they were totally not expecting to leave 28 days later. I'm so fascinated by people moving into murder houses. I'm kind of shocked that it sold so soon. I mean, it was the 70s, you know, they were really living on life back then, but... While unpacking to enjoy their new home, a Catholic priest showed up to bless their home. Kind of random. It doesn't say if he was called. As the priest went upstairs, entering the master bedroom, he began sprinkling holy water, and then a voice told the priest to get out. And naturally he did, which I think that is fantastic because I've never seen that before in any horror movie ever. Like they said, get out. And he's like, oh shit. Okay. There's a real one here. Got it. The priest did not tell the Lutz family what had happened upstairs, but he did warn them by saying, do not use the upstairs room as a bedroom and do not let anyone sleep in there. The Lutz family was confused, but they listened to the priest and turned that bedroom into a sewing room. From the beginning, the Lutz family claimed that they felt weird sensations whenever they were in the house. Within a few days, the family's personalities had seemed to completely change, and random arguments would ensue randomly through the entire family. George was plagued by a constant chill and spent all of his time feeding the fireplace. George also noted a change in his grooming habits, and his and Kathy's health declined drastically. The Lutz's daughter began spending all of her time in her room playing with an imaginary friend. She was described as a red-eyed pig called Jody, who could transform not only in shape but size, at times being larger than the house. Jody also claimed that she could not be seen by anyone unless she wanted them to. Then mysterious foul odors would come from different locations of the house. Black stains appeared on the toilets and ceramic fixtures. Kathy apparently was touched by an unseen force, and a green gelatin substance would appear throughout the house. If you are not thinking of that episode of SpongeBob with the hash-slinging slasher, exit off my podcast. Exit off. No, I'm just kidding. But that's instantly what I thought of when I was like, green gelatin? What? I've never heard of a haunting like this. Hundreds of flies would appear in the sewing room despite it being the dead of winter. They just wanted to warm up, Kathy. Come on. George would randomly wake up nightly at 3:15 a.m. I do too. I have dogs. Which obviously it did coincide with the time that the police felt that the DeFeos were murdered. But George also awoke one night to witness his wife transform into a 90-year-old hag. That's what the website said, not me. And the next night, she began levitating over their bed. Interesting. Sounds fun. The Lutz family tried on numerous occasions to contact the Catholic priest, only to find that the phones would cut out whenever they would try to call. After failing to get the priest to return, the family took matters into their own hands, armed with crucifixes, and they would walk throughout the house reciting the Lord's Prayer. A chorus of voices erupted, and in response, asking them, "Will you stop?" The final night was reported to be the worst. Banging and rappings as loud as marching bands, apparently. But it would go throughout the entire house, furniture being moved by itself, and the children were being terrorized. After 28 days in the DeFeo home, the family claimed that they could take no more. They grabbed only a few belongings and fled the home, taking shelter at Kathy's mother's home in nearby Babylon. And this is where our good old friends, known as Ed and Lorraine Warren, make an appearance. 20 days after the Lutz fled, Ed and Lorraine were called by Marvin Scott, who was a news reporter with Channel 5 New York and covered the Amityville story and had also worked on a prior investigation with the Warrens. A team of reporters, investigators, and parapsychologists were assembled by Ed and met at the home on 112 Ocean Avenue. Duh. Come on, guys. The Lutz family refused to re-enter the home during the investigation. Are they scared or is that commitment? During the investigation, Ed was physically pushed to the floor while using some religious provocation in the basement. Lorraine was also overwhelmed by the sense of a demonic presence and was plagued by her psychic impressions of the DeFeo family's bodies laid along the floor covered in white sheets, and a sense of physically being pushed back. The research team also captured an image of a spirit that appeared as a little boy peering from the second floor. I also think it's important to note that the land was also found to be used by John Ketchum. John Ketchum was a practicing black magician and had a cottage on the land prior to the construction of the Dutch colony in 1924. John requested that his remains be buried on the property, and they remain there till this day. The Shinnecock Indians, I'm so sorry if I'm saying that wrong, also at one time had an enclosure on this land that was used to house the sick and the mad. Basically, left in this enclosure were left to die. The Warrens believe that the suffering there had left the property with a negative energy and dark history. And such a negative history was basically a magnet for demonic spirits. The Warrens believe these energies directly impacted the lives of both the DeFeos and the Lutzes. The Warrens retrieved a handful of the Lutzes' earthly possessions and the deed for the property, and then the Lutzes sold the rest of their belongings and relocated to California. The Ocean Avenue home that was once purchased for $80,000 in 1975 sold for $950,000 in 2010. And again, it's on the market. There have been no further reports of activity from recent residents, and meanwhile, several other investigations into the Lutz ordeal have produced vastly different conclusions. Parapsychologist Stephen and Roxanne Kaplan asserted that the stories allegedly invented by the Lutz family was basically an attempt to deliberately defraud the public for profit. According to the New York Times, noting several glaring discrepancies in the various accounts of this event, they alleged that the Lutz couple had concocted the occult happening for the purposes of cashing in on related media attention. There's even claims that the Amityville Horror book and, you know, all of the films are based on true events, but they believe it's entirely false. There was also a note that Ronald DeFeo Jr.'s lawyer, William Weber, admitted that he, along with the Lutzes, created this horror story over many bottles of wine in hopes of gaining a new trial for his client. Can you believe that? That they can just smack based on a true story on anything? It's also so outrageous. Like, I know whenever you're a defense attorney, you have to. Like, I don't know how you do it, but you have to, regardless, do what you can for your client. Whether you believe they did it or not, that's your job. But it's just so outrageous that even after he was convicted, he's like, I have to get him off. Like, what kind of story can we come up with? And then, like, they just make it all up? Are you kidding? And then, okay, so say it is made up. What does that make of Ed and Lorraine? They say it's haunted. It's in their file. It's in one of their case files. Oh, honey. We're going to have to go there and look ourselves. Like, do you guys want to throw down some money for it with me. Like, we can have a giant sleepover. I know most people are against Ouija boards. I played with one when I was in third grade. I thought it was just a scary board game. I called my mom and asked if I could play a board game. She said, yeah. I didn't tell her what it was, but I don't know. Do you guys think it's really haunted? I mean, obviously, like, there is some dark energy there, especially, like, if that's what was going on in the land well before the home was even built, yeah, there's some dark energy there. Do I think that that dark energy affected Ronald DeFeo? No. I think he just had some anger management issues, maybe some other mental stuff going on too. And he didn't like to be told no. He didn't, even though he was behind the robbery, he didn't like that nobody believed him, his lies. I think he was troubled, clearly. I don't think he should have, I'm glad they didn't give him an insanity defense or anything like that, but I don't know if I believe the Lutz's story, especially after they were finding evidence that's not true, but then at the same time, you're like, Ed and Lorraine were there. Someone release me that footage so I can watch. I want to see Ed get, like, thrown to the floor, like they say. Anyways, if you guys think it's haunted or not, let me know on the Instagram post. If you would like to follow along online so you can see photos of the cases that I talk about, my Instagram is at Mads Monsters Maniacs, spelled just like the podcast, but without the and. And if you would like to email me any stories of your own, recommendations, anything of that sort, my email is madsmonstersmaniacs@gmail.com. I hope you guys enjoyed this week's episode, and I will be back real soon next week.